recorded was always in my head.
Checkerfin? Checkerfin?
Yes!
Rissy Education Gadfly
Sex Actions.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college high school
is
pain and suffering. In your face.
That they be preaching, cause here's the Education Gadfly Show.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here with my co-host, the Joe the Plumber of the Education Policy Community, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike.
Ricky, so did you enjoy last night's debate? Finally, education gets some airtime.
It was a dazzling display of reformist sentiments, wasn't it?
Indeed it was. But first of all, it was interesting that Bob Schaefer, the way he teed up the question.
I
imagine that the folks at N08 were very happy. He basically said that we were spending too much money in our schools and that we were trailing most of the rest of the world.
And so Obama's three-part plan, spend more money on pre-K,
right.
Give more money to folks to go to college, and hire an army of teachers.
Right.
Whereas wow.
McCain's plan was to add a few vouchers in Washington, D.C.
in one city.
And let the ripple effect just flow across the heartland.
Well, and, you know, his compelling defense of choice was that we know that choice and competition work. Thanks for a sophisticated rendering of the choice argument.
But you're so cynical because right now Jay Green up on his blog is making a big deal out of the fact that Obama embraced competition. He said competition from charter schools is good for public education.
And I'm sure Jay would be equally excited by Castro's Cuba, where you can find multiple bodegas in Havana. That clearly means that the competition is taking place in Havana.
But, Jay now says that you and I and Saul Stern, we're practically to the left of Obama because he claims that, we don't think that competition does a whole lot of good.
Sometimes I just want to go back to the classroom and get away from this silliness. Rutabagas. Is that a vegetable or is that a car?
Yeah.
Winnebagos are the car.
Winnebagos is a car. Rutabaga
is a vegetable. I want to go can you raise rutabagas in like the Dakotas?
Yes, I think you can. It's sort of a northern kind of vegetable, right? Is that right?
And so in North Dakota, better than South Dakota.
Yeah. I'm looking around here. What are we? Vegetable expert. We got a bunch of East Coast intellectuals around here. What is this?
Amber's a Virginia girl. She knows about vegetable raising.
But what do you think? Maybe next year, Joe the teacher will get some press instead of Joe the plumber.
How about Joe the overextended, entitlement happy, stressed out homeowner who's irresponsible and has refied a couple times to go buy cool kitchen appliances? Wouldn't you just love to see McCain and Obama agree that what the American citizenry needs is a good smack on the butt?
I don't think that's very likely.
Yeah, me neither.
Rick, this is the Education Gadfly Show. We're going to stick to education. We got lots to cover today. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear Education Amber's Research Minute. Mm-hmm. Stafford's going to rate that reform.
Wow.
Whew.
Wow.
Lots to cover.
Good times.
All right. So Molly the intern, as opposed to Joe the plumber. Molly the intern, get us kicked off.
Well, Russ Whitehurst is leaving the Institute for Educational Sciences.
No!
What's his legacy? Should he be remembered as finally getting federal education research on track? Or will IES be seen as yet another failed attempt? And who should replace him?
Rick, you're the researcher.
I think Russ's legacy is going to be pretty substantial. He's clearly changed the direction of ed research. He changed the way that the community of ed researchers talks about its work. He's had an enormous impact on the work that goes on at universities. Personally, as I've said before, I think, it's understandable but unfortunate that Russ has had a rather particular view of what constitutes good research and a relatively narrow understanding of how it should be usefully pursued. But at the same time, it's hard to imagine how he could have done things differently given the culture he's pushing against.
Do you think it'll stick?
I think it'll be unrolled some. I think a lot of it's going to come to this question of who's going to get appointed in the new administration.
Okay, so I know that you're pushing for Linda Darling Hammond, is my understanding. No, who do you think? What do you think?
I think if it's a Republican administration. Okay, fair enough. All right, if it's a Democratic administration. A couple great choices would be Tom Kane up at Harvard University, Dominic Brewer out on the faculty, University of Southern California, Jeff Hennick at Teachers College Columbia would all be really interesting possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Katie Haycock? Look, I think Education Trust has a long history of using research in interesting ways.
Define interesting here, Bill.
Creative, but also persuasive. All right, Molly, question number two.
Schools in Texas were required to test special education students at grade level this year for the first time under NCLB, and lots more failed to make AYP. Meanwhile, a special school for extremely disabled kids in Maryland failed to make AYP this year because of its low attendance rate. Should we stop including special ed kids in NCLB accountability?
Absolutely. Rick, this is starting to really drive me crazy. Now, I know that we're all supposed to talk about special education kids in a very special way. And you saw that in the debate last night, some of the discussion about autism, which also was a little confusing. I'm not quite sure what point McCain was making at times. And I guess Sarah Palin, she knows something about this.
Apparently.
Okay.
And she feels it deeply.
But here's what I feel deeply, is that including special education kids, particularly as a separate subgroup under No Child Left Behind, is corrupting the entire accountability system.
Strong words, Mike.
Very strong words. And you want to know why?
Why?
Because if you are a state official and you are trying to decide how hard should I make my test, if you know that kids with cognitive disabilities or learning disabilities have to be able to pass your test, you're going to aim awfully low.
So do you just want to leave special needs kids behind?
I want to leave them behind. No, I don't want to leave them behind. But you know what? I think we have to have some common sense here. Obviously, the reason that children are getting labeled as, you know, having learning disabilities or other cognitive disabilities is because they're not learning at grade level. They're not learning up to standards and may not have the ability to do so. So let's not pretend that it's otherwise. And I think that if you know, that we've got to restore some balance to this process. And if the IEPs are supposed to guide what kind of education those kids get and what kind of assessments they take, I think we should go back to that model. I understand the special education advocates are worried.
Isn't it a compliance model? Aren't they worried that it's going to be all about compliance and paperwork and not about getting these kids up to snuff?
Right now, we have this concern out of this important but very small group of students that is corrupting the entire education system. If we want to raise standards and have more rigorous tests, we have got to deal with this issue. We got to deal with it honestly.
But then aren't you just going to over-identify your low performers?
You mean as a way to
as a way to get them out of the general population?
No. Look, you're still going to, you know, you can still include, if you want to include these kids in the testing, include them in the accountability system. Just don't break out the results separately by the subgroup. And then that way, you know, some of these kids don't do well in the test, the school can still make AYP. All right. But right now, they, you know, a lot of these schools are failing AYP because of this particular subgroup. It doesn't make any sense.
I think the proponents for exceptional children are going to be concerned about what you're putting forward here, big guy.
Yes, send the hate mail to rhess@aei.org. Okay, Molly, final question.
There's a lot of debate right now about whether teachers should be able to wear campaign buttons in the classroom. Is this a free speech issue or a case where political neutrality is in the classroom is key?
You know, we've been thinking a lot about free speech lately, Rick, because just yesterday there was a Fordham-sponsored conference at the American Enterprise Institute that will result in a Brookings book about courts and education.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to get that plug in there. So what do you think? Would you wear a button if you were in the classroom?
You know, I think that kind of political advocacy just has no place in schools or classrooms. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that the role of teachers is to shape children into individuals. Part of this is not teachers proselytizing. It's not teachers trying to advance particular political perspectives or points of view. And it's certainly not teachers acting as spokespeople for unions or other organizations. Strikes me that professional responsibility suggests that teachers, when they're within school grounds, mm-hmm. owe it to their kids to stay arm's length away from advocating particular political positions.
I mean, that just seems like common sense. And yet Randy Weingarten up in New York is suing the New York City Department of Education for enforcing regulations that require that kind of neutrality. Mm-hmm. You know, in the federal government where I once worked, you know, the rules were very much the same. You know, you couldn't walk around with the campaign button. You couldn't put up, you know, big banners in your office. And in fact, if you were going to park your car in the Department of Education garage, which I did not because I rode my bike to work. Okay. Mm-hmm. But and I didn't
very really, impressive.
Thank you. I just want to get that in there. Is you couldn't even have a bumper sticker on there because, you know,
sure.
So, you know, but after work, you know, on your own time on the weekend, of course, you have the right to political expression.
You know, I mean, we do. You know, this is something we impose even on office holders. You know, senators and presidents mm-hmm. are expected when they are traveling for partisan purposes. They're not supposed to utilize public assets. Mm-hmm. Schools are public assets. President's not allowed to call for phones from the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. Senators and cabinet secretaries aren't supposed to fly to partisan political events mm-hmm. using public planes. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why Randy thinks it's okay for teachers to use public schools mm-hmm. where children are required to attend
yep.
as places for proselytizing.
You know, I'm going to be interested in how this plays out. You know, 3 weeks from now with the election, you know, there's a big expectation that the youth vote will turn out. There's going to be 18-year-olds who are seniors in high school. I mean, should they be allowed on election day to, if they're standing in line waiting to vote, you know, and miss class? Would that be appropriate? Do they need to vote before school, after school? What if the voting's at their own school?
Oh, it's kind of like if you have a job and you want to vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, people just skip their work for a while. Doesn't everybody?
Ideally, no. Ideally, you go after work or before work or on lunch.
Lines are so much longer then. Okay, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Now we have special minute of the week. For those of you out there who may not spend your life looking at research, doing research, at least we give you, it's like broccoli, we give you 1 minute a week of education research. So, Amber, give us the broccoli. Let's introduce... Amber's Research Minute.
You search, we search, research. It's the Gadfly Research Minute.
I feel so much more mellowed out. Okay, sure, Amber. 1 minute of broccoli starts now.
All right. There's a report out from conservative-leaning Goldwater Institute this week. It's called Florida's K-12 Reforms and Their Lessons for the Nation. It examines the 10-year impact of various reforms implemented in the Sunshine State. These include Florida's A-plus accountability program, which grades schools A to F based on student performance, their policies to end social promotion, school choice, pre-K programs, just to name a few. The mostly positive research findings add up to what the authors call a remarkable improvement in Florida's NAEP scores, as well as Florida's Hispanic students who are whipping up on the overall average of all fourth grade students in 15 other states. So some impressive gains in Florida. I agree there's a lot to love about Florida, but other reports, including some of Fordham's own, have found that, for instance, Florida's standards lack specificity. Still, states would be wise to take a page from the Florida Reform Playbook.
And with 5 seconds to spare.
Woo!
Woo! Amber, wow. Well done.
Hey, but so I guess say my song?
Yes,
song.
What is the song for this week?
Florida is the Sunshine State, right? So our research splice song is You Are My Sunshine, which is the song that my mother sang me when I was just a chubby little baby.
Oh, it's going to bring tears to my eyes.
And it was written by a Southern governor.
Okay, let's take a listen.
Oh, you are my sunshine.
Is that right, Rick? What Southern governor wrote You Are My Sunshine?
You know what? I think it was one of those Louisiana, colorful Louisiana governors back in like the 40s.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that.
You know what? If that was broccoli, baby, that was candy-coated broccoli. That was good. That was tight. She sounds... Amber sounds like NPR-ish now, doesn't she?
She's only been doing this for, six, 7 weeks? She's much better than we are.
It's a little frightening.
It's depressing. So, Amber,
we're going to lose her to NPR pretty soon. I see it now.
I know. Well, it's like we lost Cooner to talk radio.
Or like we lost Liam.
Yeah, right, to,
something.
Okay. So Amber, this question
about... Or like we lost Kobe to Starbucks.
Right, exactly. So Hispanic students are in Florida are just knocking the socks off
That's
of
right.
Hispanic students elsewhere, but also all kids
students,
elsewhere
yes.
in fourth grade reading.
That's
pretty
right.
impressive. Some people will say, well, you know, Hispanic children in Florida are different than Hispanic children elsewhere. We're talking about children who are of Cuban descent or, you know, that may not be as poor as other places. What do you think about that? Did they look into that question at all?
They did not look into that question. No, they did not. The report just mainly aggregated a bunch of disparate pieces of research from other folks. I think the bottom line was, you know, hooray for Florida. It wasn't a particularly rigorous report, if I can say.
Mike, I think it would be racist to look at these. We know from NCLB that there's certain permissible categories of American citizens. There's black people,
right.
Hispanic people,
uh-huh.
white people, and so forth.
Yeah.
We don't have these fancy subgroups that you seem to be interested
in.
Sub-subgroups.
Yes.
So I think it's better not
You're
just
right.
better not to go there.
I don't know. Maybe we should go in the other direction. I think we should break it down by, you know, all, I don't know, 217 distinct ethnic groups that are in the United States. And, you know, I want to know. You know, how are the Cuban Americans in Florida doing versus the Cuban Americans in New York City? I think that's important. Well, thank you, Amber, for joining us for your Research Minute.
Sub-subgroups. I like that.
Sub-subgroups. Sub-subgroups. And now we segue to Stafford. Did you like
all
that?
All right.
Stafford, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Let's rate that reform.
All right. So imagine this. You're a bus driver. You work long hours, maybe a couple of jobs, and your husband's out of work. You're having a rough week. It's Tuesday, and for some reason, the kids are really going at it. Screaming, teasing, yelling, the works. You think to yourself, did their last period teacher give them extra sugar just to drive you crazy? All you want them to do is just quiet down. You know, use their inside voices. So what do? Well, according to one bus driver from Dayton Beach, Florida, the solution here is to stop your bus full of kids on the train tracks and tell them you won't move until they're quiet. And that's what she did last week to a busload of Campbell Middle School students. And the ruse may have worked if a train hadn't appeared on the track headed straight for the bus. It's not clear if she told them this before or after said multi-ton speeding projectile appeared, but she told them that she'd get off the bus and leave them there. In the end, it seems the bus driver didn't actually want to have the death of 40 middle schoolers on her hands, so she backed up the bus just in time to make it under the crossing guards. Wow. Well, there really isn't any problem definition here, seeing as kids making a fuss on the bus isn't too extraordinary. But execution, F. F. This quote-unquote solution probably produced the exact opposite reaction that it intended. How do you think 13-year-olds react when they think they're going to die? Oh, I don't know, scream, maybe cry. They're definitely not going to sit on their hands and behave. They're middle schoolers, and you're telling them that you're going to leave them in a contained space to be flattened by a speeding train. I just hope this particular bus driver doesn't have any of her own kids, because she'd probably hold them up by their ankles off the side of a bridge if they refused to eat their vegetables.
Wow.
Wow.
That's pretty good. That's right. But I don't know. I mean, who knows? I'd be just curious about the next day what that bus was like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's a good chance that those kids were probably not misbehaving.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I think the bus driver was suspended.
Actually, you know.
Too bad.
For me, there's really three.
A failed chance of it. That could have been a natural experiment.
Right? Yes. There's really three takeaways here, I think. Well, one, that is a problem, right, that we can't learn about these kinds of interventions because we're always suspending the people who could be the experimentors.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'd say the first thing here is I really like the bit of Dr. Seuss that Stafford gave us. The fuss on the bus.
Ah,
that's good stuff.
Nice.
Second I got to go with is I'm not sure whether actually it's an interesting, you know, interesting physics experiment for our high school listeners out there. If you hit a bus filled with kids with a train, I don't think they get squashed. Usually in the movies, what happens is they get thrown and hurled and it rolls over, kind of like the beginning of The Fugitive.
Right.
Remember when Harrison Ford gets up?
Yeah.
But third and most significantly, I got to say, having spent a lot of days in classrooms with high schoolers and middle schoolers, the opportunity to walk them out, stick them on a bus and leave them some train tracks has a visceral appeal. So at least I'm sympathizing.
Oh,
I'm empathizing.
Oh, Rick. You know, someday if you do decide that you want to give it all up and go back to the classroom, you know, some state certification board is going to come back to this tape and say, you know, he's unfit to serve.
Thank God for private schools.
That's right. Yeah. Unregulation, huh? There you go. Wow. Well, thank you, Stafford. That I have to say, it did have shades of the old News of the Weird. But
yeah, not a lot of reform there. I mean,
it was more rate that solution this week.
Hey, I'm not complaining, all right? I mean, I'm loving it. I mean, this is good. Important for people to know about.
So. It is, indeed.
Absolutely. Whew.
Well, I'm glad that everybody is A-OK.
Oh.
And on that, let's say that we are out of time.
Beauty.
So we're going to be back next week, right?
I think.
I mean, it used to be that you would travel, gallivant all about, but these days you've just been around, Rick.
I think I'm in Philly Monday and Indianapolis Thursday, but I think I can be here on Wednesday, baby.
It's a sweet spot. I'm liking that. All right. Well, till next time.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.